Dublab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Ron Hansen?
This is Ron speaking. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Ron. What a pleasure to have you on the line. I'm so delighted that you're part of the Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Onassis LA and Dublab. Ron, tell me, where do I find you and how have you been living these last 14, nearly 15 delirious months?
Paul, you find me in Taichung City, Taiwan. It's the central city of Taiwan, and well, our experience here has been a little bit different to most people. Actually, until very recently, Taiwan had only experienced 12 deaths this whole pandemic. We hadn't locked down once and had been living a pretty regular life. I mean, the economy was booming. Taiwan was receiving glowing media coverage all over the world. And unfortunately, recently, Taiwan's defenses were finally penetrated, and we are in our first serious outbreak of the pandemic.
What changed?
Well, the two big things happened. First of all, there was a hotel where pilots quarantined, and it turned out this hotel broke the rules by housing regular domestic tourists in the same building as these pilots and air crew. And then possibly the biggest thing was they reduced the quarantine for pilots and air crew from 5 days to 3 days. And then suddenly just a whole bunch of them got infected with the UK variant, and they got out and they went around. One of them went to a sports bar and unfortunately got into the hostess clubs of the Wanhua, the oldest district in Taipei. And then once it got in there, it was, you know, it was pretty well out of control. So as the pandemic has progressed, there's been a lot of knowledge and a lot of discussion. And so while Taiwan was ahead of the game, now, you know, we really have some catching up to do, because there's only so much energy you can give to a crisis that's happening in other countries. You know, even myself, I'd really paid a lot of attention to it, and I'd done a lot of reporting on this in the New Zealand media, and because New Zealand was really studying Taiwan's response and learning from it. And I was really following it. But, you know, around December last year, I was just like, you know what, we haven't had any issues here, and I just want to just focus on publishing and the arts,
right?
And studying Chinese.
We'll get to that, but one story I think it's so interesting is that the one way in which you prepared was because one doctor was sleepless.
Well, it was fascinating because there was a health official. He had set his alarm for the wrong time by accident, and he woke up early in the morning and he couldn't get back to sleep. So he's scrolling his phone and he goes onto a chat room and he sees some charts and hospital charts that had been originally posted by a doctor from Wuhan. And he looked at it and he thought, well, you know, this looks pretty serious. And so immediately, you know, let the government know. And then literally within hours of that, the government was screening passengers at the airport from Wuhan. And, you know, so the mobilization was instant. And then, of course, this guy became a bit of a hero. And then very shortly after that, Taiwan sent some officials over to China to, you know, get some information. We're not part of the WHO. You know, we're blocked from participating in that and sharing information and so forth. So Taiwan has to be self-reliant. So they sent a couple of people over there to find out what was going on. And very early on, they determined that this was airborne before it had been announced by the WHO. So, you know, we were ready to go here. So it was just, you know, the popular, we had this experience with SARS. I was here back in 2003, and it was quite a frightening experience. You know, in the end, the death toll, you know, I think it was 73 people. There's a bit of debate around the death toll, but it was 73 people. It wasn't too many in the end, if you compare it to what's happening now. But at the time, we just had no idea of what this was. We had nothing to compare it to. And the only thing we could really think back to was the Spanish flu. And so, and there was just, it was a little information. So we're, and of course, SARS was, it turned out to be a much easier virus to stop. But if you got it, the death rate was around 10%. And you had a lot more younger people dying from it. And so, you know, we had a hospital that the epidemic here, the local epidemic, took root in a hospital, Herping Hospital, and they had to lock it down, and it was just chaotic. You had a patient committed suicide, and a nurse tried to jump out of a window, and, you know, doctors and nurses were hanging protest signs out the window, and, you know, between 26 and 34 people died in that hospital, including the head nurse. So everyone in Taiwan, we were all watching this, and, you know, the WHO refused to provide Taiwan with information, samples or tests, and we were left to our own, and we, you know, suddenly we were the hotspot, with the epicenter. And so it was just this this terrible thing of going through this tragedy and just sort of being abandoned by the international community. So
yeah, what I wanted to ask you also, Ron, is before we get to, and I'll just say the name and let everybody sort of look forward to the mystery solved of white fungus. Before we get to that, could you say something to our listeners about, you know, the boom in Taiwan that happened during this pandemic up to this moment, which you're discussing now as being a really challenging moment, of something that's called the Gold Card Program and what it entails?
Yeah, well, because the pandemic had been kept under control here, suddenly there was a desire of a lot of people to move here, a lot of high-skilled people, including Taiwanese who lived abroad. So they had this gold card, which is a visa for highly skilled professionals. And just the numbers of people taking up that, obtaining it, just increased dramatically. So I made a couple of really great friends here who I was actually introduced to through via DubLab. And so people were coming here and starting businesses, and you know, the economy grew around 8% in the first quarter here, and it was last year, it was the first time that Taiwan's economy outpaced China in several decades. And so it was just a very exciting time, and a real feeling of confidence. And because, you know, Taiwan doesn't, you know, Taiwan is diplomatically isolated, and it can't participate in the Olympics under its own name, is excluded from the WHO. And then suddenly, like, Taiwan was getting all this media coverage, and people were becoming interested in Taiwan. So it was a great experience, because, I mean, I know for myself, I'm from New Zealand, and, you know, all these years, I mean, so many people there couldn't even really distinguish between Taiwan and Thailand. And so suddenly, like, you know, the leading epidemiologists in New Zealand were pointing to the Taiwan model, and I was getting invited onto the media and television, radio, print media, and, you know, talking about what was going on here. And then suddenly New Zealand became really interested in Taiwan. And so that was just a great experience. And unfortunately, the stories turn sour, but hey, we're human beings, right? We screw up, we make mistakes, and human folly has a way of finding it, you know, of dominating affairs over time.
Human folly has a long history. Ron, I want to tell you that I'm in reception of an issue of white fungus, which took me totally, utterly, and delightfully by surprise. And this is a name you gave, and there's a story behind it, you gave to a magazine that you publish that emanates actually from Taiwan. I think a brilliant name, because like the bald soprano of UNESCO or some of the most advanced forms of surrealism, one really doesn't know what it might mean. It made me really think of Breton's wonderful line where he said, the man who cannot visualize a horse galloping on a tomato is an idiot. And here we are with this magazine called White Fungus, filled with strange and wonderful articles. And if you could give our listeners a sense of what might happen if they happen upon an issue of White Fungus, which now I believe has 16 or maybe 17 issues.
Yeah, we're currently working on our 17th print issue, and we've started doing a lot of online publishing during the pandemic. But, you know, we wanted to make a magazine which really gave you no clue on its cover as to what would be inside. You know, we didn't want it to be, you know, so many magazines, you know, you look at it and there's an identification. The magazine almost creates the reader. It almost produces the reader. It's like you're this kind of a reader. Whereas we wanted a magazine to be like the cover. It just had to stimulate the curiosity and compel certain people to begin turning the pages and just to get lost into kind of a kaleidoscopic world and a collision of different ideas and language and art forms. You know, our most recent issue, number 16, if you flick through it, it begins with an epic article about animal music.
Tremendous. It really is tremendous.
That's by a writer in Berlin called Tobias Fischer, and he had co-written a book on the subject, and we just said to him, well, could you crystallize that book into an article? So it ended up being a really long article, and just what the sounds the animals create. You know, is it purely functional, or is there pleasure involved? Is there creativity that can be compared to what humans do? And how much do we even know about our own creativity? So it just raises all these questions. It starts by talking about the elephant orchestra in Thailand, which is this group of elephants that creates music, and they presented a concert in New York of compositions that have been written down that, you know, were produced by the elephants, and they asked the audience, you know, who do you think created this music? And people were like, oh, John Cage maybe, or, you know, so
I have to interrupt you for 1 second. Many years ago, I had the artists Coma and Melamed come. I was working then at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, and they had paintings that were done by the tail of elephants. And the same thing happened, Ron. People would say, well, no, it. I mean, it's hard to say. And then they would name a number of famous, you know, maybe an early Jackson Pollock, but they were not sure.
Well, I think it's a really, and it opens up, I mean, is that whole stereotype of, you know, people who like to deride abstract painting, saying, well, a monkey could do it or whatever, you know, but I mean, what if the monkey was actually a great artist? You know, so, I mean, it raises a lot of questions. You know, how much do we know about what animals are doing, and what do we have? And you know, in the same issue, there is, just to give you an example of how we have a lot of different content, but there are certain threads that emerge. There's also an interview with Carolee Schneeman. It's a 54-page interview with the, you know, who, unfortunately, she passed away not long after this interview. It was one of her last major interviews. But she, of course, created artworks which were collaborations with her cats. So I think it's just kind of an interesting thread where you've got these two articles which are very different, but then it ends up just being a thread that runs through them. It's not in terms of genres, it's just sort of themes or ideas that just sort of, you know, we kind of intuitively dive into the material, and then the threads just kind of, you know, they make themselves known as you get deeper into it. And then you try and, as you realize that, you're trying to accentuate them a little bit and find ways of connecting them. So, and there's also an article by the writer Kurt Gottschalk from New York about a concert of Max Richter's Sleep in New York, where the audience actually goes, the concert happens at night and everyone goes there and actually goes to sleep while the concert happens. And it's just like, and so he, you know, talks to different composers about, well, is, you know, because it used to be frowned upon falling asleep in a concert. It's almost like an embarrassing sort of a thing to do. Like, but what is, who's to say sleeping through a concert is any less of an experience than staying awake in the concert? And, you know, just so the article just sort of explores the value and whether we should, you know, reconsider our the way we view something like that. So I guess we're just, you know, in a way, all these articles are challenging our perceptions and the way we categorize things, our limitations, and raising doubts about what we do know, and just hopefully just stimulating people into just giving everything a rethink.
You kind of have a tagline for the magazine where you say that it's done in the spirit of pure anarchy, a pseudo-anonymous protest against corporate interests. And I think in a way it delineates perhaps your marching orders. It reminded me of a wonderful publishing house in New York called Akashic Books, and their tagline is reverse gentrification of the literary world. If you had to now in some way say White Fungus after 15, 16 issues, how could you say what it might be? I mean, you have already, of course.
Yes, I mean, it's to really come up with a line is as good as the one you've just mentioned. I'd need to give it some thought and crystallize it. But it would be hard to do justice to it just by plucking something out of my head in the moment. But certainly it began in the spirit of pure anarchy, because we didn't intend to start a magazine. It was just a sudden decision. We decided to, it was a protest against a road that was being built in Wellington, New Zealand, which was going to cut through the, and it did end up cutting through the arts district, destroying heritage buildings and seeing evictions of artists from their studios. So it was a very spontaneous decision. And of course, we were young and we were energetic and rambunctious. And, you know, you mentioned the avant-garde. I mean, I think that was always our dream, was just, it was early 20th century avant-garde. I remember learning about it in high school and thinking, yeah, that's the kind of life I want.
Yes.
Without realizing how hard it would be, of course, knowing the sort of deprivations that you'd have to go through, or the struggles. But, I mean, the main thing is that, you know, the White Fungus, it comes from a can of White Fungus, which my brother Mark discovered in our local supermarket. And, you know, White Fungus is actually, it's a Chinese delicacy. It's often served in soup. It is believed to be good for your skin and for your digestion. And in Chinese, it has a very benign meaning. But when it gets translated into English, it's jarring and it's unsettling. I mean, certainly when we started the magazine, you know, people were like, why are you calling it this? And
right.
And then I remember an art gallery was going to advertise our second issue, and then they pulled us aside and said, would you consider changing the name of the magazine? Because they liked the magazine and they thought it was great, but they didn't like the name, and we refused, and they withdrew the advertisement. So it was, but we just sort of, you know, I like that idea because, you know, what is it? And by, you know, because is it a fascist magazine? But hang on, a fascist magazine wouldn't call itself White Fungus. And then when you bring in the sort of nutritional value of the actual, you know, the actual organism that it comes from. And I also like the sort of, as a concept for distribution, the idea was we'd just throw the spores to the wind and just sort of see what happened, rather than, you know, finding a market segment and saying, okay, we're going for this kind of person, and we're going to, you know, go through these gates, and we're going to use these codes, and you know, and appeal to whatever gatekeepers we need to appeal to,
right,
to reach that segment. It was more like, let's just throw the spores to the wind and then just observe the results and then take it from there.
And then that gesture also is a kind of gesture you make towards the reader, saying, you know,
yes,
I trust you, and I, in a way, you're enticing people into the unknown. You're saying, let your curiosity lead you and be perplexed by what you might find, because you know, you're going to open this magazine at your risk, and you might find something about animals and music, but you might also happen upon an article about the great Czernowitz poet from Bukovina, where my grandparents were from, an article which is extraordinary about Polzelan.
I mean, I'm really glad that you enjoyed that article, because we were really excited about publishing it. It's by the New York writer Barry Schwalbski, and, you know, we had some contact with him, and we were communicating, and he said, hey, would you be interested in an article on Paul Celan? And, you know, we weren't really familiar with Celan's work, because I'm not really, you know, I don't read as much poetry as I should. But I had a look at it and thought, wow, this is just incredible stuff. And, you know, the name of the article is Making the Stone Sing.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
He brings this idea of having to break your teeth on the words as if they're like rocks. I mean, it's, you know, he borrows the idea from the poet Jean Dev. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. And I think the thing with this, because so here, you know, you might be reading White Fungus and thinking, wow, these guys they know so much. They're experts on this, they're experts on that. But it's, you know, as I'm revealing to you, I wasn't an expert on it. But I think the point is that what we'd created or facilitated had stimulated something in Barry's mind, where it prompted him to think, hey, well, if there's all this freedom and this sort of stuff flying around, how about this? And so it creates a certain momentum, whereas, so we're being surprised. And I like that you say that we trust the reader, because I really feel like we try and meet the reader and on a very equal footing. We're not preaching to the reader. We're not, you know, teaching them something. We're not, you know, sharing our great expertise. We're exploring the world. We're exploring material that we've only just become familiar with ourselves. And through that adventure, we're, you know, hoping just to, you know, for adventurous readers to join us. And then the responses we get from those readers help sort of create the way forward.
Come on a journey with us. It reminds me of another great magazine that comes out of Beirut called Zafar, which you must familiarize yourself with if you don't yet know it, which also you don't know what you will discover. I contributed to it once with a transcript of an interview I did at the New York Public Library with RuPaul. And, you know, RuPaul in Beirut, that was really interesting, both to RuPaul and to the readers of Zafar. And when I say trust the reader, it means you trust their curiosity. You trust the fact that people can happen on things the same way your brother happened on a can of white fungus. It comes back to this notion, which I adore and which I imagine is not at all strange to you, but rather familiar, which is a notion of walking down a street and bumping into things, which another way of talking about it is digression, and another way of talking about it is just the marvels and the deliciousness of serendipity.
I mean, that's exactly what it's about. I mean, it's just about opening yourself up to this. And because we're in this sort of paradoxical time where we have so much access, and yet at the same time we're at the mercy of these algorithms, which are kind of herding us into separate categories and feeding us up things that, you know, that meet our expectations. Whereas, so you've got to force yourself. And it's an old-fashioned concept in a way, just, you know, back when the city was a novel thing and people, you know, artists and poets would just walk through the streets. And I think for us, because we moved to Taiwan and it was such a different environment, you know, from New Zealand where we grew up or other Western countries which we'd spent time in. And that it dislodged us from our usual patterns, and it just stimulated us into just exploring things and finding inspiration in the supermarket, or just, you know, or a tagline that you find ridden on a motor scooter. I remember there was one, because he would, back in those days, all the motor scooters had strange little sayings, and there was this one that we really loved. It was, "We reach for the sky, and neither does civilization." And we just thought, what is this? You know, like, there was just this haphazard use of English, because Taiwan had changed. It had gone from this, you know, this the longest period of martial law at that time in world history, since surpassed by Syria, you know, to a democracy, but also into fully fledged consumer capitalism, and there was this rush to use English branding, and so it was just so many accidents that you would find, and so you'd see combinations of English words that you just could have never even imagined it. You know, if you had been in an English speaking setting, you just would have never even thought to put words together in such a way. And then, of course, when we started learning Chinese as well, and that just sort of opens you up to a different approach. And it's also humbling, you know, because when you learn, you know, I've been learning Chinese for a while, and it's still just incredibly humbling. And it just gives us, you know, so I think we just have a different engagement with language. And the other thing is we're outsiders. You know, we grew up in Wellington, New Zealand. You know, we didn't grow up in New York, Los Angeles, or Berlin, or London, or, you know, we were in Wellington and New Zealand, and then we moved to Taichung City, Taiwan. So we've always kind of been on our own, just in our own world, creating our own worlds.
What you do reminds me so much of what Vinicius de Moraes, an extraordinary composer, musician, and poet from Brazil, he once said that life is the art of encounter, even though there's so much discord or dis-encounter throughout life. But life is the art of encounter, and happening upon so happily on White Fungus, that is what happens. It's really an encounter. It's like meeting somebody, bumping into somebody, and discovering something new about them. And I'm wondering, Ron, in closing, if you could tell our listeners how they might come upon White Fungus.
We have a distributor, so we do, when we put out a print issue, we don't put out the print issue very often, and we've got a little bit of trouble at the moment because we're having trouble mailing magazines due to the pandemic. But we do have stores. It is available online, and we're publishing quite a bit of stuff online as well. But it is you can order it online. And then when we put out we're working on our next print issue. It's going to be, I think, our most surprising issue to date. I won't tell you what's going to be in it, but we've got some pretty unique content that we're working on from Taiwan, with stuff that you just can't read about in English. So it's going to be really surprising. And so, but when it gets into a lot of indie stores, sometimes in galleries, but there is, a bit of serendipity about where readers find it. It's almost, it's strange. It's not patterned. I mean, we often don't, you know, even know where it ends up, but it gets out there, but not in a very orderly fashion.
So it's half a secret.
It is. I think most people who learn about it do learn about it. It is an encounter. And I think, you know, often people see it in some odd setting and it surprises them. And because of that, they have this sort of this individualized, this personal moment with it. And so I think it makes the experience for each reader quite unique. And, you know, we're always reaching out because, you know, we haven't been in big centers of culture. So we've always had to push the envelope and reach out and see who we can get in contact with and who's open to engaging. And we find people and we try and get a copy to them and just get their response and just see and then just take it from there. So, but, you know, because when you're in a city like Taichung, because, you know, we're in an ironic situation because there's not many people in the city who can even read White Fungus, you know, so because it's a difficult read, and, you know, for a lot of people, even if English is your first language, I mean, I don't want to say it's, hopefully it's an enjoyable read, but, you know, it's It's challenging material. It's
demanding.
So obviously, if English is your, if you speak Chinese, then so. But we're in a weird situation. We're a very good profile in Taiwan. Everyone knows about it, but because we've had a lot of media coverage here, but and we've held a lot of events and done stuff, but we don't have too many people who can read it. So, but we have done some publishing in Chinese, and we're going to look to do more. I think in the next year or two, I'd like to. What I'd really like to do is I'd like to make a publication with just some of our best material and get it translated into Chinese and make something specifically for Taiwan, because Taiwan's been very good for us. So I'd love to make a publication that's specifically designed for Taiwan.
Ron, we will include in the notes to this program whose hunger might be by their appetite might be open now to reading and encountering White Fungus. Will make available how they might find it. But I must thank you now. Really, it's been a joy to talk to you. And as I said, I learned a lot from the various issues. I read one online, the most recent one, and issue number 15, which thankfully I now possess. So I'm really, really grateful to you. And I, as I said, I really loved your piece on Paul Celan, and it reminded me of a line of his that I've always treasured, where he says that poetry is sort of a homecoming.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a great way to end. And thank you, Paul. And I'm blown away by how well you seem to understand what we're trying to do. Maybe you understand it a bit better than we do. So I appreciate that.
All the very best to you.
You too.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.